this session. This is session number 214, and the title is Happily Ever After, Lessons from Mixed Faith Marriages. I've met most of you. I'm Roy Schmidt, and I'm happy to be moderating today and very glad that you have come. I have some housekeeping to attend to. Congratulations for surviving your first full day at Sunstone. We're excited to open our Friday sessions. Today we invite you to reflect on the diversity that exists in this space today. All of those in attendance today are brought together through various paths in the restoration movement. As you move through your day, feel free to reach out to a stranger, make friends with someone new, and let yourself be challenged. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones be turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session following the remarks of the presenters. Those who cannot abide by these guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they be disruptive. And I have Alfonso here who can help to move you out if that's necessary. I don't think it will be. The session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both the audience and the presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. Now, a few things about this session. How does your relationship with the church affect your spouse and your relationship? Is your spouse willing to talk about things from their point of view? Can a mixed faith marriage work? In this session, people both believing Mormon and not, who are in mixed faith marriages, share their stories as well as tips and strategies for making mixed faith marriage work. Nicholas Stewart grew up in the Mormon church, got married in the Los Angeles Temple, and has served in four elder quorum presidencies. He's no longer an active believing member of the Mormon church, active in transitioning ex and post-Mormon social media groups. Nick is a fan of forums like Sunstone where people can share their stories and experiences. Nicholas has a master's of urban planning and a bachelor of arts in American history. Originally from California, Nicholas and his wife now reside in my hometown of Baltimore, Maryland, that rat-infested, filthy place where no human beings want to live, where he works as a transit planner. Alan Mount is a California native, quickly approaching just as much time spent in Utah as his birth state. Alan experienced religious trauma as he familiarized himself with church history over the course of 2017. At the beginning of 2018, he and his wife started the Mixed Faith Marriage podcast, Marriage on a Tightrope, under Bill Reel's Mormon Discussion Family podcast. When Alan isn't thinking and breathing Mormonism, he's a director of enterprise sales for South Jordan-based In Movement. Alan and his wife, Kathy, have four children, ages 5 to 13. I said Kathy. I should have said Katie. I apologize.
It's my aunt's name. It's not that weird. Or I guess really
That's
weird.
Even weirder.
Katie Mount grew up in Springville, Utah, and is the oldest of eight siblings. She studied creative writing at BYU from 2004 to 2007. Katie had a passion to serve those around her and is always looking to put a smile on a face. In January 2018, she wanted other mixed face couples to feel that someone knew what they were going through. With her husband, she started the podcast Marriage on a Tightrope to tell her story as a believing spouse in a mixed faith marriage. Katie loves baking, playing games with her four kids, and all things Disney. Matt Howard was born and raised an active believing Mormon. His father was a church employee. Matt is active, served a mission, attended BYU, and got sealed in the temple. He served in most leadership roles in ward and stake, though not stake presidency. Most recently a bishop, and before that, Matt served with the stake high council. Matt has four kids. The oldest is a return missionary, and second are both out of the church. Two at home, and that Matt and his wife, Tricia, are raising in the church. Tricia, along with her husband, Matt, is a moderator of Mormon Mixed Faith Marriage Facebook group. She's a mom of four, a suburban chicken farmer, and organic gardener who loves health and fitness. She has her CrossFit L1 and gymnastics certifications, and after recently receiving her associate degree, she's heading back to school in the fall at University of Houston to finish her bachelor's in anthropology. We will start the presentation in just a second. I would like to remind you that, assuming we have time for questions at the end, if you are going to ask a question, please come up and speak in one of the microphones because we are recording. I like to always have something that is a little on the higher field of literature to begin, and so I'm going to quote in Nick's honor a poem that was written by a Baltimore poet that some of you may have heard of. His name was Ogden Nash, and this poem is called Lines on the Antiquity of the Flea. Adam had 'em. Nick, are you going to start us off?
All right, good morning, everyone. My name is Nick Stewart. This is probably the most you're going to hear from me during this particular session. This is my fourth year at Sunstone. I came 4 years ago kind of on a bit of a whim, and I found my home here at Sunstone, so I'm still here. So 3 years ago, I organized my first panel, which was people telling their transition stories. I did that again last year, as well as doing a panel like this one. And I think I did another, a third one, I can't remember. And then this year I have four that I've organized. it's like a habit, but it's a good habit, so it's okay. Mostly a good habit. I still consider myself to be in a mixed faith marriage, even though both my wife and I no longer attend the church. Because we're still not in the same place religiously, honestly. We've both left. I haven't attended in several years. For her, it's been a year and a half-ish plus. We agree on a lot of stuff. We have a lot of the same sort of reasons as to why we're not super interested in returning. But we are we are still in different places, spiritually, interest in religion, faith-wise. So we are still technically in a mixed faith marriage. I think most people are. They just don't necessarily know it. They don't see it that way. As I was talking to Matt here before this started, I think a lot of folks figure if themselves and their spouse can both check the Mormon box or Catholic box or Jewish box or whatever it is, that all the subsequent boxes that are like the smaller points with that kind of fall under that everything's kosher. Realizing I said Jewish and kosher. But I think in reality, most couples have items that they don't both check that are those subsequent items. To me, they're mixed faith, not because they're like diametrically opposed in the big picture, but on some of the smaller items. So in light of that, and then also just my own experiences both with my own marriage and then in the spaces that I tend to inhabit in social media, where a lot of people leaving the church and trying to figure out, you know, how do I keep my life together when so much is changing for me and how that's impacting those around me. I just found that 4 years ago when I came to Sunstone, there wasn't a conversation happening here yet about specifically about mixed faith marriage from the viewpoint of people that were in them. There was a lot of, like, and there are great, and, like, even this year, there's great sessions from mental health professionals talking about, strategies from a very, proven sociological viewpoint about how to make those work, not as much from people who have done it. And so that's kind of why I organize sessions like this. I'm really grateful to have some really great people here. They will be doing most of the talking after this. I've known Alan. I grew up with Alan. We're from the same home ward. Great family, great guy. I've met his wife, Katie, once before today in Santa Barbara. And then Matt and Trish I know from social media, because I'm a social media junkie. And I'm in the Mixed Faith Marriage Facebook group, which is a fabulous group, and I desire all to receive it. That's a line that's an automatic response. I can't help that one. On that note, I just want to encourage everyone to think about the concept of what a mixed faith marriage really is. And I think that people should, again, kind of think of it as something more than just I'm in the church and my spouse is out, because even people who are both in the church, even both believing, are not always on the same page. So in light of that, I'm going to turn the time over to these four folks, and I'll chime in if I have something else to add, but thanks for coming.
So we actually came up with a number of talking points that we'll work our way through. These are all interactive, and certainly feel free to stop us as we go. Everybody's in a different place, and so we just kind of have a number of anecdotal points, right, to talk about. And we'll just kind of work our way through as a group these numerous points and get as far through the list as we get, depending on how much interaction we have. I think the introductions were up for plenty, so we'll just get straight into it.
We're hoping to get through them pretty quickly. Numbering got all mixed up, but we have 20 number one points.
They're all that important.
What? Yeah. In fact, that's going to bug me. So as you talk about the first one, I'm going to go fix it. Right. But we're going to try to get through them really quickly, because in sessions like this that we've been involved in, so much of the value is in the interaction and the Q&A, especially if those in the room are in a mixed faith marriage. There's a lot of conversation that is more helpful than dialogue, than monologue. So I'll give this to Katie and go fix my mistake.
So just as a precursor here, Trish and I started our faith. She started a faith transition. She's the one that would define as out of the church right after I got called to be a bishop. So much of what this process was distilling through was while we were serving in there together, and I think that was important, because you are forced to manage what is a workable solution here, right? And so to that point, I think the spirit of overarching point is, if you're committed to your marriage, you get to stay in, you have to stand in, you have to sit with discomfort until you figure it out. So slowing down and doing that, which is the first point. Successful marriages are not built exclusively on adherence to church standards. Couples must have other things to draw from to make them happy. I've heard it said that a faith crisis doesn't necessarily make or break a relationship, but it certainly reveals it. And so for us, as we were going through this particularly awkward time initially, I came very quickly to the realization that I was going to have to make that choice. Based on certain things that I had heard, maybe certain things I had misheard, I came to the realization that if I was going to be an active member of the church, I was going to have to do this in a different way than what I thought. We started out both Orthodox, and we are not now. And something had to bend in order to have us not break. So I think the main point in that is, if you are in a situation like this, realize that that's true. I'm not talking about can you hold your breath and suffer through a mixed faith marriage. I think absolutely we can do that. We are all pioneer stock, right? We can do anything. But the point here is how do you actually thrive? I believe we're here to thrive. And so in order to do that as a couple, you get to move. You get to realize and focus on things that are not exclusive to the church. And that one point, because it is so often hard to extricate the differences, because as a born and raised Mormon, like my wife and I were, temple marriage, covenants, all of those eternal goals together seemed completely enmeshed between what church was teaching and what the marriage was all about. And we've realized since that there are definite differences and certainly good values that can survive and thrive even if they're not based on the Mormon faith. So there's...
Well, that was a very positive note to start on. Katie, you want to talk about the devastating one next?
Yeah, thanks a lot. So when we started meeting with couples, and almost instantly after we came out with our podcast, we had a lot of people who emailed us and talked to us about their marriages. And I was in the business of saving marriages. That was like my goal, was to save everyone who came to us with their problems. I wanted them to stay together. And it wasn't until probably, I think that was a very naive thought. And after about 6 months, I realized that some of these relationships were not good to begin with. They were anemic. They were riddled with problems. And when you add a faith transition on top of it, I think it pushes people over the edge. Having said that, I think it's wrong to think that if you get divorced, that the problems will go away. Because you still, a lot of times, have to parent with that ex. And if you have children involved, you're looking at a lifelong journey of dealing with kids. And so I think that it's important, if you want the marriage to work, you really have to do a lot of work. You have to go to therapists, licensed therapists, that really can help you through a lot of your issues. But you also have to be okay knowing that maybe that this is just one extra thing that's too big, that that isn't meant to be. And I think that that's a big lesson we learned. And now I think rather than saving marriages, we try to provide a space for both couples to speak their truths and for them to get the resources they need in order to work through it if that's what they want to move forward with.
So that third bullet point we've already talked a little bit about, of everyone on both sides need to be willing to change. And I think for the spouse that is transitioning out, that means obviously we're changing. We're the ones that caused all this mess. And so I think what I take in that, what I take that to mean for me is I have to be willing to change towards or bend towards her side as well. All of the bending can't be expected, and change can't be expected for my wife or my spouse to make concessions towards the non-believing side. I have to do the same towards her side. So asking her what's valuable for with her involvement in the church. And her answer is primary. I love primary. I love serving in primary. And so one of the ways I can support that is... I'm exposing your technological ignorance, but she doesn't enjoy to learn about how to put videos onto thumb drives. And so I do it for her. And there have been Sundays, I'm talking 2 years ago, it probably wouldn't be a problem now, but we'll see. But there have been Sundays where she's like, can you put this title of this video from the website, church website, onto this thumb drive for me for the lesson? I'm like, yes, I will support you in your...
First you said, can I just teach you? And I'm like, no, I don't have time.
There's something about fishing in the Bible about teaching, but that's anyway. So, you know, you go to put the video on, and it's about a topic that you're like, oh, I can't support that, and oh, she's going to be teaching the kids about this, and that's the bending that you have to do. You have to say, no, she's asked for my help. I'm going to help her. I'm going to give it to her, and maybe I'll send her a podcast about the topic later. I'm just kidding. Any thoughts on that specific one? Okay.
Okay, the fourth one. This is resonates highly with those that are believing members of the church, and that is this problem of moral high ground. I think a thriving marriage cannot survive when one person thinks they're better than the other person is the fundamental issue here. And for me to feel either I'm holding out hope by staring out the window looking for my prodigal wife to come back and praying for her to come back and ministering and mobilizing the ward for her to come back. Remember, I was the bishop during this time, so I could do all of that. Rather than that, when I finally just let go and realize that what I realized was that this sheet of map that we call this plan, God's plan of happiness, it occurred to me for the first time that that was a small part of the map. It was not the whole map. And just because we got to the edge of it and couldn't see beyond it didn't mean that it wasn't there. And more importantly, it didn't mean that God didn't know it was there, which meant that I could let go and not be afraid that she was lost or she had fallen off the edge, but rather that instead I could let go and I could trust the very things I had been taught my whole life and just realize that she's got this, God has this, and then together I could just let her be where she was. Whether she ever came back to the church, whether she hated it or loved it, none of that was important because we together were on this journey of faith. And her map just happened to be one quadrant over from mine. And when I realized that and allowed for that to be the case, I could come off of my moral high ground and I could just walk next to her.
And neither do I spend any energy expecting him to leave and join me. I've had a few people say, like, oh, don't you just want him to leave with you? And I said, no, I really want what's best for him. Because he's miserable to live with when he's doing anything he feels like he has to do. So I'm like, you must do what is best for you. And I just honor that on every level. That's he gets to follow his path just like I've given permission to follow mine.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I tend to see and have seen, and not just, you know, particular to mixed faith marriage situations, but the sort of Mormon missionary mentality that we all have because we're Mormon at some point, and that when people leave, they sometimes turn, the missionary mentality still continues, but now it's trying to get people to leave because for all the same reasons that you try to get people to join when you're in the church, right? I know this to be true. This is like, you know, this is the good news. I love this. I want you to, you know, all that same stuff, and that tends to happen just the opposite. And that is really damaging to relationships, whether they are friends relationships or, you know, romantic ones. And I think that probably the best thing I did when I was transitioning out and my wife was still active is I told her this, like the conversation that we had where I was like, you know, I don't want to go to church anymore. I was like, but I want you to keep going. I don't want you to feel like you need to not go because of me. If it's good for you to have me there, I will try to still attend when I can. But I can't guarantee that I can be there every Sunday. I can't guarantee that I'm going to sit through certain lessons. But if that's important to you, I'm willing to do that. But at no point have I tried to convince her to leave or to. I don't even share information. sometimes she'll ask me, and I'm like, I can tell you where to read about it, but I'm not going to be the one to explain it to you because I don't want to I don't want to do that to her because it's rough to transition out, and inflicting that on someone else is also rough. But also, people need to kind of get there on their own, as far as I'm concerned, and so I think that's a really good point.
So the next one is the timeline. There is no prescribed timeline with this stuff. I attended for about 18 months. As a non-believer before I stopped attendance. And I know people who, we've talked to listeners who are in bishoprics, who are non-believers, and they've been non-believers for 12 plus years. A buddy of mine who right at the same time encountered the same information and went to disbelief at the same exact time as I did, he's a good friend of mine, he's currently in a bishopric. And there's reasons for that. I could not do that, but he can, and he is, and he's not ready to disrupt his life, and he has his reasons for that. Just yesterday, we talked to a couple here that talked about the spouse, the wife is out, and the husband was saying, like, yeah, she's probably right. I'm just not ready to destroy my parents, and my grandparents are going to be dead in 5 years, and I don't want to do that to them. And from someone who does agree that the church is not true, that's my stance, it would be very easy for me to point at him and say, like, dude, you just got to do it. You just got to do it. But it's like, no, you have every right to take this journey the way in the time frame that you need, and there is no prescribed destination. It doesn't mean he has to leave eventually.
Okay, number six. This one is focusing on common values. There is a really dangerous concept I've heard in the church called cafeteria worship, which means that you get to pick and choose what you believe in and leave the rest, which makes you feel like a lukewarm member of the church. But what I have discovered through my time is that we are all cafeteria worshipers. What that means is, what's that? Yeah. What that means is that we all have things that bind us. We all have personal experiences. My children have unique perspectives from me because their perspective is different, and they have had that on their own terms, which means in that sense they have something to teach me, not because they're better or I'm better, but just because their experience is theirs. So I really struggle with that notion. I think it is dismissive. I think it can be shaming. I think it can be self-shaming. And what it does is forces people into that box of it's either yes or no, all or nothing, which, as we all know, relationships aren't made like that. So I think that the concept here that's important for us to remember is that there is so much common ground in any relationship. I could get anything and create, this would be the challenge, right? But if you took a Democrat or Republican, if it's politics, if you took an atheist or a believer of any faith, all of us have common strains of interest and also shared values. So the bottom line is find them and then focus on them and not the differences.
The next is number seven, which is find someone that can listen. Find someone you can chat with that's not your spouse. That can, especially at first, can be perceived as a threat to your spouse. But man, as soon as you both can recognize they need someone who is in their position to talk to and to vent with, that's so important. I was lucky enough, I was blessed to have my brother go through the same experience as I did at the same exact time. And so that was a really good outlet. But he lives out of state. So what I did at work is I paid attention in the break room of who was getting a cup of coffee. And I would just walk up to them and say, what's your deal with the Mormon Church? I lost some friends that week. But no. And some of them were like, oh, I've never been. And okay, that's cool. But I found a few people that are like, oh, you know what? I actually am stepping away, and it's been pretty recent. I'm like, me too. Can we please talk? And I still, to this day, one of them particularly has been a super close confidant and a really close friend that, thankfully, he's also in HR, so I can trust his confidentiality. But it's been a very big help. Yeah.
I know you've likely addressed this on your podcast, but I have a brother going through a very similar transition, and his wife is very, very scared by his faith transition. And what often comes, and I'm a therapist, and I work with these issues on a daily basis, and I notice that what often comes up is the more traditionally believing spouse is very threatened and scared that the other would be talking with somebody, and not only them. And I'm just wondering if the two of you could say just a little bit about that and what that's been like for the two of you. Thanks.
Thank you.
So I think it took me some time to realize why he needed someone to talk to. I was pretty upset thinking, knowing that he was going on the sub-Mormon, ex-Mormon Reddit group, talking to people, because I felt like it was a cycle of just negativity, and I didn't want him to be in that space. But what I didn't realize is that he was already feeling all those negative feelings. And I could not show up to listen to those feelings because I couldn't deal with what was going on myself. And so it took time for me to realize he needed those spaces, those Facebook groups, those Reddit groups, people at work. He needed that because I couldn't be there for them, but they were there for them. And in the long run, I felt a lot of gratitude towards those groups, and I still do. It definitely took some time. I think part of the issue was that I didn't feel like I was being supported. There's no support for, you know, people in our position. And so I felt like he was getting the support he needed and I wasn't. And so it was important for me to seek out individuals and groups where I felt safe to share my own feelings. And when someone else has been able to talk me or walk me through, since there is no roadmap, it did wonders for me. So that would be my advice, is to seek out individuals or friends that they can talk to. I think that was really helpful for me. And it helped, and time helps. I mean, just time heals a lot of that pain.
And just a quick follow-up. How about his, and you can just repeat it, how about his really close relationship with his brother and other friends?
So how was my close relationship with my brother? How did that impact Katie?
Again, I thought at the beginning that it was, they were just going back and forth, feeding off of each other. And that was also really hard. And so we talked a lot about it. He would tell me the stuff that he would tell his brother. Sometimes I didn't want to hear it. Sometimes I did want to hear it. But I think the key is communication. As long as I felt safe, he wasn't leaving me, I wasn't leaving him, then we could go back and forth a little bit. But again, it just takes time.
And there is some, one sentence, there is some trust that is placed in, she has to place trust in me that I'm not going to take advantage of those conversations. I'm going to be respectful in those conversations. I'm not going to be throwing her under the bus in those conversations with my brother, with my friends, that it truly is a grieving process and not a separation from my spouse, and I'm just going to be complaining about her to my brother because that's not what it was. So talking to her about some of the things that I've talked with my brother, she was able, over time, she was able to see that that wasn't the purpose of the conversations in the first place.
Okay, so this is a question to play devil's advocate, and so I don't know. But my question, I guess, is did you ever find that talking to someone else made it worse? Because actually, it's interesting that, Katie, you said that you didn't feel like you had anybody to talk to. I felt like there was, like, a plethora of people that were willing to, like, oh, I'm so sorry, and Satan just has a hold of him, and, like, all of these types of things that are not helpful, because that's not the case, right? And sometimes I think it can cause the non-believing spouse, or however you want to, I don't know that I love those terms, but I feel like it kind of villainizes them a little bit in other people's eyes, which is not super helpful, even though you want people to feel, you want to feel supported for the pain that you're feeling and people that love you. And then on the other side, I think, so also from the idea is, are you sure that's helpful? I guess is where I'm going with this, is the idea that, I mean, at least in our marriage, we always had it set up. We never talked to other people about the problems in our marriage because we could always talk to each other. We never went to someone else about that because we didn't need to. And so I don't know how to phrase that in a better question, but if you get my drift, I guess.
So to the first point, I would say that those people weren't being supportive, so there wasn't actually support. There were people who were willing to give you what they felt was going to be the right thing to say, but they were not actually being supportive. I highly recommend the Mixed Faith Marriage Facebook group. Highly recommend it. Great group. The spouses on both sides of the faith divide are in the group. Really good conversations happen in that group. It's probably one of the healthiest Facebook groups I'm in, not going to lie. Because I'm in some real crazy ones. Right. Yeah. Your second point, I had a thing. I can't remember. Someone else, sorry.
I just wanted to add something really quick to that. So I've had a few trusted confidants, you know, as I've transitioned out. And that was really important for us. Matt is very communicative and wants to talk about everything, but I could not process some of those emotions with him, some of those struggles. I couldn't. So what I did was process with those trusted friends, and then we would come back together and have short conversations, kind of taking small chunks at a time, maybe one topic at a time, and they tended to be very productive, so that was really helpful for us.
So I need to throw myself under the bus. As the quasi-believing, I'm still attending, and I'll throw myself under the bus in saying that I was struggling allowing my wife to talk to others. And there were some other things going on with our children as well, but that I was fearful of what was being portrayed to other members of the ward, where most of the members of the ward know where I'm at, but I couldn't get myself, and I'm still struggling with that. And so I wanted to find out from those who are on the other side of the faith divide, have you had struggles? Because I'm sure that many spouses that start going into that transitional state don't necessarily want the whole world and the whole ward knowing, because we all understand that things get around. We're really good at sharing each other's struggles to everybody in the ward so everyone can pray for us, right? So can you share a little bit about that and how that's happened with you?
The dynamic in the marriage may be different for different folks, but it may not be a shock. I'm happy to talk to anybody about how I feel about anything. So for me, it was the opposite. It was, I'm not going to talk to people in the ward because I don't want to make her uncomfortable. So once she was in a place where she told the ward council, because she's in ward council, this is where Alan's at, I was like, yes, I'm myself. And this was, 8 months, 9 months after we started the podcast. So we were very open, but very closed in our own little knit community. So that's how it worked with us. So we didn't have to deal with that.
Yeah, we didn't really deal with that very much. Matt didn't talk to very many people. He was the bishop through, I was still going to church right up until he was released. And this was something we were dealing with very, very, very privately. So.
How is it now? But my wife needs to talk to somebody, right? And I need to allow that to happen. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. And you feel like, and you're the one that's uncomfortable with that, or?
I was the one that I was struggling because of who. I was fine with my wife talking to people as many as she wanted to, but it was the who she might talk to that was a struggle because of.
That left you feeling vulnerable?
So, yeah, I think what I'm hearing is as the believer, the non-believer side, and your wife, yeah.
The apostate, we'll just say it.
Thank you. See, I think we're all quasi-believers, back to the point of the mixed faith. That's right. It's agreeing on a safe place. So I would have that conversation about, I'm thinking about talking to my brother. I'm thinking about talking to a counselor. I'm thinking about talking to my parents. I'm thinking to whatever. Then you get to be part of that discussion. And then you can also talk about the fact that there's certain rules of engagement where if you do talk to somebody, they need to know X and Y and be someone who can absolutely be trusted to not share that with anybody else. And we had that conversation with almost every individual because both sides of it, right? It can get out quickly and turn into a mess. But talking to somebody other than the one person, really helpful, because I call this the napalm effect, which is you are going to throw some heat, both sides. It's anger, it's grief, it's the stages of healing, right? That getting stuffed down is absolutely the wrong thing to do. So how do you let it out without burning your partner? And so I call the napalm, go to the trusted source outside. And then when the cools down and you're ready to re-engage constructively, that's when you come back together to have a couple talk.
Yeah. We had had enough conversations that I knew if someone came to her trying to say that Satan's gotten to him, she wouldn't have it. So before kind of opening the floodgates of let's make sure we have someone to talk to, we were on stable ground as far as we knew we were not going anywhere. We knew I knew that she didn't think Satan had a grasp of me. And so when she gets an email from a family member that says, you might want to think about leaving him, the conversation we had about that wasn't, well, should I? It was, what do we do to save this relationship with this family member? So it wasn't a threat, because we had already kind of had that conversation.
So yesterday, Anthony Miller said something kind of in line with this. But when he was transitioning out, he and his wife would talk, and at a certain point, his wife said, "You know, this is too painful for me. I can't be your person." Right, and so that was the point at which then Anthony was able to go out, and he basically had then the permission to go and have those conversations with other people. And I think the same thing applies in the opposite for the folks that are, you know, that are still in, still believers, whatever. That there needs to be a point, like, and that needs, and it's like been said, like, it needs to be a decision, it needs to be a conversation, because people often feel obligated to only have their spouse as their person. And permission needs to be had sometimes for before a person feels comfortable doing that. And then, as was said, like, the parameters can be set about, you know, what can be said to who, you know, express the concerns, you know. You know, my wife was concerned about, you know, some of the less the people I would say things to, even more the things I would say, that I would say, because I'm a little crazy, that I would be a little too inflammatory or whatever to people that, you know, we're probably okay, but then might not turn out to be because I pushed too hard or something. I went to Facebook where I don't know anyone and I don't really care. I think that it needs to be a conversation, and I think that both spouses need to feel okay saying, I'm not comfortable being your person for this.
I think the next three kind of fit into that. Do you want to kind of summarize?
Let's go
okay. Number 12. We're going to go to number 12. So we're going to try to catch up because we do want to make sure we have time for more interaction as well. But number 12 is Katie.
Both the believer and the one transitioning will go through the steps of grief. You are feeling the same kinds of feelings and can relate to each other more than you realize. Let's see what I wrote. So more recently, alcohol was a hard thing for me. It wasn't a hard thing for Alan, obviously. You know, he wanted to try it. And his first couple of experiences with alcohol was pretty positive. It was just the two of us with work friends. But more recently, we went to his house where he has four siblings who are out, three other siblings who are out. And we had a party one night, and it turned into like drinks and alcohol, and it was really difficult for me to not that I hadn't been in party situations, but be with people who I knew and loved, who we had common core values, and now we don't. And seeing everyone do that was really hard. And I think that you go through waves and stages of grief, and Alan does too, for the identity he's lost, but also for the identity in my future that I've lost. So in those times, I think we've learned time and time again, it's best to turn inward towards each other rather than turn outward and be filled with grief and pain and hate. It's better to talk about it and to realize and validate that the other person is going through something that's hard. And when we did that, it made things a lot easier for us.
So number 13 is take time to regularly nurture your marriage in ways that are unrelated to faith. So Matt and I have been together for 25 years, and we have four kids and a really demanding life, like all of you probably do. We've always had really demanding callings and given them our all. I've said in the past, I used to Mormon competitively, so like I was in it to win it. So our life was crazy. And when this all kind of came down and Matt got released as the bishop last fall, we looked at each other and we're like, let's start over, you know, like let's get to know each other again. And so we've really taken some time together. Matt decided not to have a calling for a little while. And we've, this summer especially, we've taken a lot of getaways just in our state. You know, we live in Austin and there's a lot of fun places to go. So we just go stay in hotels for a couple of nights, leave the kids with a sitter or whatever. And we just go and just spend time talking and getting to know each other kind of for the first time. And that has been so enriching to our relationship and really has changed things in ways that we did not anticipate and has been so beautiful for us. So,
let's see. Okay, don't be hasty or unilateral in your decisions. You are a team. The best example I can give of this is we've got children, 13, 11, 7, and 5. A lot of times we now disagree on how to raise them in and out of the church, what we will allow them and not allow them to do. And so Alan and I really think and take our time and talk about the decisions we make together. And I'll tell you this, they're not always on the same page. But we are in agreement when we go to our children to talk about these decisions that we will say, we're actually not in agreement with this, but here is my point of view. Here's Dad's point of view. What is your point of view? And we let the kids decide for themselves. And I think that that ultimately will be a gift for them. But we teach them a lot about making decisions and opinions. And so we really try to lay the groundwork for that. And we're not always on the same page, but that's okay. But we do put up a united front, and we're together. And we don't talk in an angry manner. We do things in a very light manner with the kids. And hopefully that comes across as being respectful, and they'll learn from that.
The next one, and I should have said this, we should have said this at the beginning, Matt came up with this entire list. And I knew he wouldn't take credit because he's just a better dude than I am. But these are all brilliant, and this next one is my favorite one, and actually the one that I think, if handled properly, is what makes a mixed-faith marriage a very big blessing. The disagreements, that is something that can be very polarizing, and especially at first, the disagreements are magnified, and it really feels like this is the end, or this is going to cause so much pain or so much strife. But it's working through those differences and in a way that Katie just explained that has brought us closer than if we never would have had the problem in the first place or the disagreement in the first place. I think piggybacking on what you mentioned, Katie, the disagreements that we've had have helped our kids. And I said this in a session yesterday, that a mixed faith marriage is a huge blessing for children. And especially I feel lucky and blessed that it happened to us when our kids were still young and would listen to us, because now they get to hear two different perspectives, and they know that they're fine. They can do whatever they want. They can choose whatever they want. We're still their parents, and we're not, you know, telling them to go start a meth lab or anything like that. And we're going to make sure that they are doing helpful things and not being menaces to society. But the disagreements are a good thing. They, sticking on the alcohol note, our 11-year-old, well, I was with all four kids in the car about a month ago, and my 11-year-old heard the word liquor in a song, and he asked me, and Katie was not in the car, he asked me, Dad, have you ever had alcohol before? I had my first drink like 6 weeks earlier. And I'm not going to lie, and so I said, yeah, I have. And we talked about it a little bit, and at the end, I think this is the whole point of the conversation, of this bullet point, is at the very end, I said, that's how I feel. That's how I feel. I don't feel it's wrong, but you should talk to your mom. She has different feelings about this. And I just left it at that. And then we talked to mom later.
Plus, kids are really resilient.
Right.
We're so scared of like giving them a differing viewpoint. They're fine. I mean, you have to work through it, but they're fine. Most kids really can handle this well.
So I will say this as the kind of the believer in the equation, this was actually super difficult for me. If I was to say, what's the one thing that is most difficult? It's parenting. children at home, the young kids. The older kids, you're like, you know what? I've given you what I can. Whatever you do, you know, we're here to love you, right? So we have two that are older and two that are younger. One's 12, one's 15. The 15-year-old just got called as the Teachers Corps president in our ward, and he's digging in and loving that experience. So I help him get to seminary, and we talk together, and he wants to go to church as much as we can. And we have a younger one who's kind of think for herself. She challenges notions. She's seen a lot of some of the social issues in the church. Before she was even 11, she was asking questions of her leaders that were what most adults do, right? So she is a thinker beyond what I had ever even seen before. I came to realize what a gift it actually is to have conversations that are based on what I call faith, or you might call it trust. If the truth is there, whatever that truth looks like, they will parse through that just like you will, just like I will. And I was just wondering, how old do you do that before you kind of hand the keys over to the car? And I realized, when is it too young is actually the question, because I believe from the very beginning, as what Alan and Katie were saying, it is a blessing to have these difficult conversations if you are framing them in a way that actually engenders respect, reflection, and trust in and not fear or judgment. And then they'll come to what they feel good about, and you have wonderful conversations. Our home evenings now, if you call them that, are actually wonderful experiences about understanding difficult things and parsing through those things and giving people room to ask questions and feel uncomfortable and then come to some resolution. So they don't start in one moment and end in the next. They sometimes take weeks or more. Or you just see somebody do something and you ask them about it. Think, well, I decided X. I'm like, okay, well, this process is working itself. So,
I'll do the next two really fast, then we'll move on. So seek to understand first. Katie told the story of this little party that we had at my brother's house, and we had some alcohol and some karaoke, and it was fun. She was super upset that night, and I knew she was upset that night, both body language and text messages. And a week later, we were at a Boston Red Sox game, and she bought me a beer. And I appreciated the olive branch, but I got frustrated because I didn't understand these peaks and valleys that she's going through. And it wasn't until last night that we talked about it. And I've been a little bit angry of just like, you yell at me one minute and then you're buying me a beer the next. It's like, this is driving me crazy. And then she kind of explained, like, I'm dealing with accepting this as well. And there's moments that I'm strong and moments that I understand, and there's moments that I'm mad. And we talked about it last night. And I'm glad we did, because this would have been more awkward today than if not. But, and we already talked about that last one with the letter from, number 17, there are only two people in your marriage. We've had some pretty hurtful things said by everyone on that list, family, friends. And again, if we've decided that it's our marriage, they don't have to agree with what we're doing. We've had parents, basically that's about it. Parents not understand why we have a podcast and listened to the first episode and called us yelling and then haven't listened since. And they haven't talked to us about it since. And we don't want to ruin our relationship with them, but we feel like what we're doing is the best for our marriage, and that's how we're going to live.
Number 18 is, what you end up with will be different than what you had before, and that's a good thing, because different can be great. So, as I said, we've been together a long time. Many of those years, we had sort of settled into our niche, each of our niches, and to me, Matt was not Mormon enough. And he would let me down, and he would do things that confused me and made me feel vulnerable and scared, and so I would push him away, and I spent a lot of time really angry at him, like a really, really long time really angry at him, and with a lot of resentment that I didn't really even recognize until I left the church. I remember I would leave, I would read the end sign cover to cover, and then I would leave it on the coffee table and watch it to see if it ever was moved, you know, to see if he was ever going to read it. I was really hard on him. And one thing that has been so beautiful about this transition in our marriage is that I got off my high horse, first of all, and we just began to really see each other more clearly. And our we're so there's this idea that you have like three marriages or several marriages. And our first marriage was probably kind of that early stage where we're just kind of in love and in the honeymoon stage. And then we kind of landed in the second marriage when the kids were born, and we kind of stayed there for a really long time and kind of were stuck there in just some of those same struggles of resentment and disappointment. And we're in this new marriage now, and it's totally different, and it's completely unexpected, but it's beautiful, and it's deeply connected, and we didn't see it coming. We didn't anticipate it. We thought everything would fall apart if I left the church. We had a lot of conversations where we were like, what will happen? This is going to be horrible. And we knew it, but we had to move forward, and the result has been really awesome. So,
we have about 3 minutes.
Me? Me? Is this really going to be worth it, these last ones? Cliffhanger here.
Sorry, I lost it.
Oh, you're fine. So 19.
Okay, compromise. This kind of goes back to that notion of cafeteria mentality. Compromise does not mean you're giving up ground. I think sometimes when you're in this, you feel like you have to protect what you have. And then it's if you say, okay, that's fine, maybe it's drinking, maybe it's going to church, maybe it's modesty and the kids, you know, wearing different clothes now or whatever, it feels to the believer like you're losing your grip. And so everything has to be held on to, and then it becomes a war of attrition. Who can push harder? Who's got the stronger grip? Who's the better arguer? Who's not tired right now? And you end up picking your battles, but they're always negative, and they're always battles. And so the whole notion here is if you can loosen up and focus on shared things again, then you can both agree, right? But then you come through the side door and say, okay, well, how do we teach this principle of integrity? And then it can look some Mormon and some not, right? There's some great things and programs and perspectives in the church that I think Trish agrees with 100%. So for those things, it's easy. For other things, she has a problem with. So we find other ways to teach things that we both agree on. That goes into the second one. The one thing I would say, this is a very, if there was a preachy moment, this would be it, number 20, and that is, I find it interesting that people see, have so much fear ultimately, not initially, but ultimately when they are presented with the notion of letting go. To me, I'm thinking, we've been taught from the very beginning, the first principle of the gospel is faith. So what does that mean? I trust. I trust that God's got this. I trust that my partner's got this. And as I'm sitting there looking at her and realizing she's not doing any of those things that I've been told she would do if she left, or reasons why she was doing what she was doing, I could just let go and say, you know what? The plan is something that I don't understand. None of us understand entirely. The future is what it is. But I can trust and just let go of the things that aren't mine to control. And I can love, and I can focus on the things that I can control, and then build. It's always about that, right? And then I guess the last thing, somebody said to us, well, you've all heard this, never go to bed angry. I'm not sure how many of you had this conversation, but we finally gave up at 5 o'clock in the morning one night, and we still were not resolved. And the next day, literally, I woke up and went, what were we fighting about? And I realized that's not, for us at least, constructive. That's not for everybody. I have her. Okay, there you go. Here's a counselor telling this, right? The notion was sometimes let it go. Come back to it later. Get a good night's rest. Go to the gym. Whatever it takes to get you feeling like you're taking care of yourself. And then when you come back, you're in your best position to deal with some of these difficult things.